Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
As Thanksgiving approaches, a few key headlines tell the story of how the recovery from Hurricane Katrina is going. Time magazine's cover story says, New Orleans today, it's worse than you think. The New Orleans Times-Picayune posted a front-page editorial this week that said, it's time for the nation to return the favor and set about fulfilling promises made to rebuild the city. The New York Times notes a fading sense of urgency among lawmakers, while the Washington Post headlines, the costliest part of rebuilding is yet to come. Well, as many Americans prepare for their Thanksgiving meal, we thought we'd check in with a few people directly affected by the hurricane. First, we want to learn about the large number of people still missing after Katrina. The whereabouts of more than 6,600 people are still unknown. Government officials aren't sure if they've simply moved on or been washed out to sea. And some 900 of the unaccounted for are children. With us on the line is Ernie Allen. He's president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And Ernie, can you explain that number? How can 900 children still be missing 12 weeks after that storm?
Well, Robin, we believe that a small number certainly did not survive the storm, and we believe that's a small number. The largest number of that 900 that we're discovering on a daily basis are children who are with a parent or with a grandparent or with another family member but don't know where other family members are, less traditionally missing children and more fractured families. And then there's a number that we're discovering every day that have reunited but haven't called us back, haven't let us know that their families are back together. The good news is that there are no unaccompanied children left alone in any shelter or any setting. All of those children have been identified and have been reunited with their families.
But it's just amazing because this is America in 2005, and one thinks that, you know, you go on the Oprah show and everybody finds you, but that's not true. So what are you doing to try to find these children and other adults who are missing?
Well, we have our Team Adam. These are retired law enforcement specialists, experts in the field of child abduction and missing child cases, who are on the ground going, in some cases, door-to-door, talking to family members, trying to reconnect. We have linked and are searching the databases of the Red Cross. We are seeking access to the FEMA databases. We're using other databases. Evacuees are now in 48 states, and many of them are still in very temporary living situations where they're hard to reach by telephone. But we're treating every case as if it's urgent, and we're not going to close the file or stop searching until every child is found and every family has been reunited.
Some of the postings on the websites are heartbreaking, of people still trying to find, not just kids, obviously, that's heartbreaking, but elderly parents. And we understand one of the complicating factors is that the morgues are having a hard time identifying some of the bodies.
Robin, many of the unidentified deceased spent weeks under the water, and the identification process is going to be slow and it's arduous. This isn't going to happen quickly. And so, unfortunately, in some of these cases, there's not going to be a happy ending. But we believe in the vast majority there will be.
It's further complicated, we understand, too, by the fact that because it's New Orleans, the relatives aren't sitting around ready to offer their DNA to try to do matches.
Well, there's no question about that. We had a case in which a dad had his 5-year-old and his 9-year-old, but didn't know where his wife was with his 1-year-old and his 14-year-old. The father was in Texas. We ultimately found the mom and the other two kids in California. So these people are spread all over the United States, and it's really almost an old-fashioned gumshoe-type investigative effort.
Ernie Allen, president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Ernie, do you get the sense, you and your people working so hard to try to find these still missing people, do you get the sense that the rest of the country sort of moved on a bit? I mean, it still is astonishing to me so many people can be missing in America, but do you get the sense most Americans have moved on to something else?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. The attention span of the nation is short, and the sense is the waters have gone down, the cleanup, the rebuilding has begun, but there's still some families in crisis out there, and we still need the help of the public and the attention of the public.
Again, that's Ernie Allen, president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And by the way, to get there to their website, you can go to ours, here-now.org. Well, as Ernie said, cleanup is underway in New Orleans and, of course, elsewhere in the Gulf. Today's Boston Globe shines a spotlight on controversial cleanup efforts in Beaumont, Texas, which was battered by Hurricane Rita. The newspaper reports that the federal government is now paying the Army Corps of Engineers 76% more to clean up debris than city officials had been paying their own workforce to do the same work. Local officials were presented with a choice: use the Army Corps of Engineer crews at no cost to the local government, or use local crews and pay for a quarter of all cleanup costs out of city coffers. Well, most local officials chose the Army Corps crews and watched the cost of cleanup skyrocket to an additional $29 million of federal taxpayer money. Well, there are questions as well about government spending in Jackson, Mississippi. The New York Times recently reported some eye-opening post-hurricane government waste in Jackson, which is 160 miles from the Gulf Coast and sustained some damage from Hurricane Katrina. But FEMA wrote checks to some 30,000 people who'd made claims and actually suffered very little damage, sometimes only spoiled food because of lack of electricity. With us on the line from Jackson is Larry Fisher. He's the director of the Hinds County Emergency Department. He says that FEMA actually asked him to adjust his calculations up to match the huge number of claims the government agency was paying out for. Well, Larry, let's find out how this works. First, can you explain, was it part of your job to record how many homes were damaged?
Yes, ma'am. Part of my responsibility in emergency management, as quickly as an event begins to occur, actually during the occurrence and then immediately after, is to make surveys of what type damage we have here in the city of Jackson and Hinds County.
Well, what did you see?
Well, we didn't see all homes or houses in the city and county, but for the most part, we did a real good survey. We went up from about 1,200 to 1,500. We increased our number of structures that were damaged up between 2,500 and 3,000. And this damage being from major to minor. Of that major, the homes that we considered unlivable was estimated at about 25 to 30 at the most.
25 to 30?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, as you well know, FEMA received over 42,000 applications for assistance from residents of Hinds County alone, 17,000 from two neighboring counties, to the tune of $20 million that they paid out. Now, when you heard those numbers compared to yours, what did you think?
Well, I got, you know, the call from FEMA at one point fairly early on, and they were asking me, you know, had I had an opportunity to relook at the area and so forth. I told them that I had. They asked me specifically about unlivable structures. And I told him, I said, well, I'm still holding with 25 to 30. But I said, taking into consideration that I did not walk or go behind each home and that there may have been some additional damage that I was not able to see, I would increase that number up to probably 45 or 50. And that's big five and a zero behind it. At that time, the FEMA representative told me that they had already sent checks out to some 4,200 people in need of money immediately for lodging and food. And then subsequently, the individual asked me again, you know, was I going to adjust my figures upward? And I told him, definitely not. I've been in this business for about 24 years. This is not by any means the first emergency declaration we've had in the city of Jackson and Hinds County. You know, someone from somewhere else talking to me and said, well, you know, this is Bubba and he doesn't really know what he's doing, so we're going to give him the opportunity to, you know, change his figures up to ours. But needless to say, I'm not going to do that.
You are not Bubba.
I am not.
By the way, who are you? What else do you bring to your job? Because we understand you were somewhat offended by this.
Well, my background here in Jackson, I served a little over 20 years with the Jackson Police Department. I retired from there in 1981 as chief of detectives and came into emergency management that same year.
I understand you're also a Baptist deacon. And I'm wondering, sir, which was more offensive to you, the fact that perhaps a government official was handing out money that to people who didn't deserve it, or that he was perhaps pressuring you to go along, or that people were asking for money when they didn't need it?
Well, I still think every once in a while about John Fitzgerald Kennedy's statement of ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Well, today's people don't do that. They want to know what the country can do for them. One good friend has a pawn shop. He also has a check cashing service in that pawn shop. These people cashing their checks from FEMA and from the Red Cross were buying guns, DVDs, electronics equipment, camcorders, things of this nature. So, yes, people lost things in their refrigerator. Some lost things in their freezer. We had a fax come into us here by mistake, apparently being faxed to an insurance company, a gentleman reporting that he had 100 pounds of jumbo shrimp in his freezer. He had two full loins of beef. He had four cases of ribeye steaks and so forth. And, you know, you suddenly realize that, my gosh, this man doesn't live in a home. He lives next to a deep freeze. So, you know, it's just not something that most people have, you know, readily available in their freezer. We've talked with quite a few people here in the Jackson area, talked with one individual that had reported by phone to FEMA that his home had been damaged, some roof and damage to the roof itself primarily. This gentleman, with no further questions and no one surveying this damage, received a check for just over $20,000. Mm-hmm. And he literally called and said, you know, Mr. Fisher, I need to find out, what should I do with this $20,000? I said, well, you know, personally, I would put it into an account somewhere and hold it in case somebody comes back after it, because the man, you know, readily admitted that at the most he couldn't have over $1,000 to $1,200 worth of damage done to his home.
Larry, I'm wondering, you say you grew up in that area. Some of these people were very honest about saying, look, I need the money, and so I'm going to take it. And, you know, parts of Jackson have struggled. Do you really blame people for, you know, if the government's going to give it to them, they're going to take it?
Well, you know, we've heard the people say that the government owed it to them. You know, if so-and-so can claim it, then why can't I? Having been to the coast, you know, since Katrina hit and seeing the damage down there, you know, my heart goes out to those people who lost everything. And, you know, seeing those people south of us that really needed the help, this is where my heart goes.
Larry, thanks for speaking with us about it.
Thank you very much for the interest. Y'all take care. Have a wonderful day.
And you have a good Thanksgiving.
You too.
That's Larry Fisher, the director of the Hinds County Emergency Department in Jackson, Mississippi. Well, just ahead, they're thankful to have a roof over their head. The problem is where the roof is. We'll have the story of a New Orleans family that has relocated to Massachusetts, home of the first pilgrims, but the kids aren't crazy about living in the woods, and Dad is having a hard time finding what he needs to make the kind of Thanksgiving meal they're used to. Much more coming up here and now. Finding housing for people affected by Hurricane Katrina continues to be a real problem. Yesterday, FEMA officials, who had been criticized for kicking people out of the agency's hotel housing program, reversed the stance and said they'll keep paying the hotel bills of evacuees in 10 states until January 7th. For many Katrina evacuees, tomorrow will be a bittersweet holiday. They are safe, but many have lost their homes and have lost touch with neighbors, and as we reported a moment ago, they've lost touch with some family members. Then there is the food. Can a New Orleans native find the food he needs for tomorrow's feast in the supermarkets in Utah or Minnesota or Plymouth, Massachusetts, the scene of the first Thanksgiving and a place that pretty much sticks to the predictable meat, potatoes, and cranberries from native bogs? Here now is Fred Tice, tagged along with one New Orleanian as he went shopping.
Terrell and Patrick Wooten used to live in the tough Algiers neighborhood in New Orleans. Now they're renting a four-bedroom house deep in the woods of Plymouth.
Yeah, but we got coons. My wife's scared of coons. She's scared of coons. Baby, that coon!
Yeah, came up the stairwell and they went on their little out and we coming home. Raccoon playing on the steps, coming up.
Their four children aren't exactly thrilled with life in the woods.
Boring.
Laquita, the older daughter, and her sister Patrice have moved up from New Orleans to join the rest of the family, who have been in Massachusetts since September. They and the Wootons' two sons all attend Plymouth South High School. The boys seem to be adapting, but Laquita, a senior, misses New Orleans. She's thinking about college. She doesn't know exactly where she wants to study yet, but she knows she wants to go back to Louisiana. The family has just spent the day distributing Thanksgiving baskets with their church, the New Hope Chapel of Plymouth. Meanwhile, their own refrigerator is full for the holiday.
I've cooked every other day.
The Wootons were able to take home one of the Thanksgiving meals they were distributing, a 20-pound turkey, potatoes, squash, onions, stuffing, green beans, corn, and a pie. But now it's time to get the New Orleans ingredients for Thanksgiving. The entire family packs into a pickup truck lent by the church and heads into a local supermarket.
Everything hooked up for my jambalaya and everything set up with the Creole style rice, dirty rice. They call that dirty rice because it's like ground beef with chicken with the liver, with the chicken liver. Yeah, you get that, you cook that all up, you know, blend it all together, put your different seasons with it. I'm going to show you how to do the real New Orleans Creole style cooking.
But the shrimp turned out to be a big disappointment.
She ain't got them fresh. They take the shrimp's heads off. I need the shrimp head. So you boil the shrimp head to make your base.
Excuse me.
Do y'all have the shrimps with the heads on them? Do you have the shrimps with the heads?
No, we did hit them all.
Oh, okay. I had mentioned the last time I came here, I told y'all I'm from New Orleans and I'm a cook.
Inevitably, when people find out the Wootons are from New Orleans, they ask what the family lost.
Well, how much damage did you do?
Oh, everything.
Wherever Patrick Wooten goes, he gets a warm reception. Now he needs oysters. Sometimes it seems as if he and the locals are divided by a common language.
Y'all have oysters? Oysters?
Oysters?
Yeah.
On top shelf, way over.
Oysters. So I use oysters for my gumbo. Yeah. For seafood gumbo. Like, they don't even have crabs. Y'all have crabs? Like blue crabs?
Blue crabs, no. We haven't had those. We haven't seen those for years. they come. our crab used to come from out west.
Oh, yeah. Everything on this way is different from New Orleans. It's like we got to have that crab for that gumbo, you know shrimps, the crabs.
Patrick and Terrell Wooten are astounded by the prices. $5 a pound for ground beef.
Ooh. See, New Orleans, you take two of these, they call it family pack. And it'd be the price of $10. Two. Come up here, man, like, whoa.
$13, babe. Right here.
Thank you for food stamps. I can't put too much in there.
I know you didn't know.
So you got milk and everything else. For the eggnog. I make my own scratch. With the milk, the egg, you beat your own egg. See, separate your eggs from the yolk. Yeah, then you beat it. You go put that with the nutmeg and your cinnamon, all that. Then you take the white of the egg, put sugar with that, and you beat it. You beat it, you keep beating it until it comes to a foam. You lay that on top. Yeah, and that's how you do that. Then you have yourself a homemade eggnog better than the kind you get. That's why everybody down there in New Orleans is obese, because we know how to cook good. We do everything from scratch. Well, at least I do. That's the way I've been raised, to do it like that.
Patrick Wooten learned to cook from his mother and his grandmother and from working on oil rigs off the coast of Louisiana. He used to go to the lakefront and to City Park in New Orleans where they would have cooking contests. He says he always turned up on top. Wooten was a building contractor in New Orleans, but it's his dream to open a restaurant or even a fast food cart serving poor boy sandwiches. Last month, he cooked a benefit meal at $50 a plate for Habitat for Humanity and the New Orleans Musicians Clinic at the Roadhouse Cafe in Hyannis.
They need some serious help up here. I need to open me a grocery store. New Orleans grocery store. All the Cajun food. Open up a restaurant while the grocery's still going on. You can sit down and eat and make groceries. Yeah, New Orleans style. New Orleans might be destroyed, but the people from New Orleans still got all the love, and they still can show the people up this way how we still show the love. Especially on holidays.
This holiday, the Wootons will be sitting down with their four children, feasting on New Orleans food in Plymouth for their first Thanksgiving in Massachusetts.
That's Here Now's Fred Tice with New Orleans evacuees in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And by the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, this is a busy time of year for food banks around the country. Demand is up, but donations in some cases are lagging. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from You Know the Drill. If you're heading out for Thanksgiving, you know you're going to be snarled in traffic, on land and in the air. AAA reports that nearly 37 million people will travel this holiday weekend, despite higher gas prices and a hike in rental car costs and hotel rooms. This morning, a major accident stalled traffic outside of Washington, D.C., where a tanker truck carrying gas exploded on Interstate 95. And snowy winter weather could slow travelers from the Great Lakes region to the East Coast. If you're flying, bring a good book. A record 22 million passengers are expected to head to airports this year. That trip will also be slowed by the weather, but also by fewer airline employees and increased security measures. In fact, travelers at about 19 airports could be asked to pass through a new security device. It's called an explosive detection trace portal, and it's the latest technology in detecting bombs. Smith Detection is one of two companies that make these machines for the government. Mark Lostra is Vice President of Transportation Security for the company. He joins us on the line from his office in Pine Brook, New Jersey. And Mark, could you first describe this machine for us? I have a picture in front of us, and we'll have one on our website, here-now.org. It looks to me like sort of one of those little photo booths that you can go into at the mall. What happens when you go into it?
Well, it's a little different because there's no enclosure. It's similar to the metal detector, the walk-through metal detector that people are used to going through now at the airport. It's a little larger, but it's a pass-through device. In other words, there's no enclosure mm-hmm. on the device.
We understand that there's some puffs of air that are blown. In fact, it's known in the industry as a puffer.
Yeah, it's gentle puffs of air from head to toe. And the purpose of the air is to release any particles that are absorbed by or cling to a person's clothing or body.
And by examining those particles, you find what?
The detector can detect up to 40 different types of explosives.
Well, we have the sound of a puffer. This is what you hear when you have this experience. Let's listen.
Please enter.
Firing check.
Please exit.
And we also have Mark Kevin Sullivan. Kevin's our colleague here at Here and Now. He actually just passed through a puffer traveling from Baltimore. Kevin, what did that feel like to be in one of those?
Well, initially it was a little bit intimidating because you see sort of this, you know, big portal as Mark described it, and it looks like something out of Star Trek or mm-hmm. something. And it's a little different from the metal detector because you actually walk and stand there. You put mm-hmm. your feet on two little footprints. The puffs of air come over you, and it's just, as he said, gentle puffs of air, nothing really obtrusive, and the folks at the airport made you feel pretty good about it.
Right.
A woman in front of me had a cup of coffee with her, and she asked, is it okay to bring this coffee through? Is it going to get irradiated or something like that? And they assured her, no, it's just air.
It's
don't
just
worry.
Air.
It's fine.
Well, Kevin, thank you. And back to Mark of Smith's Detection, which makes the puffer. So, Mark, what happens with those particles that the air blows off a person's body? We understand they settle at their feet. Then what happens?
Yeah, they're collected at the feet, and they're analyzed by a technology we refer to as ion mobility spectrometry. And within 7 seconds, we get a reading on whether or not the person has explosives on them.
So it's pretty quick in and out.
Yes, absolutely.
Mark Lostra, Vice President of Transportation Security for the Smith's Detection Company, speaking to us from Pine Brook, New Jersey. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, for more on airport security, we turn to Sarah Gu. She covers these issues for the Washington Post. And Sarah, how many of these portals are around the country?
Well, they're only in 19 airports right now, but more are on the way for two reasons. Congress is really pushing this technology as a way to close the gap in a weakness of airport security. And the second reason is that we've seen in the past last year that, as in Russia, suicide bombing attacks are a big threat and they're a big vulnerability in U.S. airports. Right now, for the most part, we just check people for metal, for weapons. We don't check for bombs. Frankly, the technology has been around for a number of years. It's a good thing to finally see them getting into more airports. Next year, there's going to be double the number that there are today.
Well, in fact, there are 25 portals today at around 19 airports. We spoke to the Transportation Security Administration. They said there's going to be 140 additional machines in large airports around the country, but they cost $160,000, pretty big ticket.
Yeah, that's true. Well, compared to other technology that the airport security has already put into airports, actually, it's fairly inexpensive. Oh. All those machines that check your luggage for bombs that go in, you know, the check luggage, those cost $1 million a pop. Huh. So this, by comparison, isn't really a whole lot of money. But the problem is that now the TSA is part of the larger Department of Homeland Security, which has a lot of budget constraints with FEMA, as you know, and the Iraq War. So dividing up the pie has become a little bit more difficult.
Well, there are some other technologies that are being used to look for explosives. What are they?
They also have technology that they can rub your hand. It looks for oils on your skin that might show up some kind of organic material that would be used if, for example, you had been making a bomb in your kitchen. The other technology that is more common, you'll see this for flyers who fly out of Florida, is they want to move forward with a registered traveler program, which basically gives a free pass through security checkpoint for people who register and provide information to the government and their address, their home phone number, et cetera. They pass a background check, and then they get a quicker pass through security.
Well, the security is, as you said, in some ways good news, but bad news on a holiday because it causes so many backups. What is the best way for people to get through security lines quickly? We understand there's things that people can do to go faster.
That's true. And a lot of it is thanks to the airline industry, which even though they're struggling financially, they've put a lot of new technology into the airports that makes it easier for passengers. And one thing that I always recommend people do is to print out their boarding pass at home. If you get an e-ticket, you can do that sometimes 24 hours in advance. That way you save yourself a line, could be a half an hour.
There's a government website, by the way, and we'll link to it at our website, where you can find out exactly what they're confiscating now because it changes year to year. But what's the big headline this year as you head to the airport?
Congress passed a law last year banning lighters in light of the Richard Reid shoe bomber. Yeah. So this is by far the largest item that they are collecting in terms of volume at the checkpoint.
Well, Sarah Gu, again, who covers these issues for the Washington Post, we want to touch down on a story that's here in Boston but affects travelers from around the country that pass through Logan Airport. Federal aviation and massport officials here have announced a series of measures to cut down on a high number of near collisions at Logan. The changes follow a string of near misses over the past year. Some of the changes include additional training for air traffic controllers, including asking them to speak slowly, and a new runway, limiting planes on runways which aren't normally used for takeoffs. But how does this story reverberate across the country?
Well, I think a lot of safety officials are watching what's going on at Logan because runway incursions remain the top safety issue, or one of the top safety issues for the country. Now, we haven't had a major fatal airline crash in this country in several years. Mm-hmm. It's a historic period. But having said that, they know that this is a vulnerability, not just at Logan, but several other airports such as LAX, and they want to see if these measures will improve the situation. At the same time, the FAA is in the middle of a very heated discussion and negotiation with the Air Traffic Controllers Union, where every week we see the air traffic controllers raising one safety issue or another. So that is also part of the context in which this issue comes up.
Sarah Gu covers airline security issues for The Washington Post. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
And have a good holiday.
You too.
Still to come, fretting over tomorrow's meal? Well, Chris Kimball of Cook's Illustrated Magazine is in the test kitchen with some tips. You're listening to Here and Now. After watching members of Congress shouting at each other last week over the war, we wondered, what's it going to be like around some Thanksgiving dinner tables tomorrow? To find out, we called Francis and Jim Coleman. Now, they're in Silver Hill, Alabama. Francis is a Republican who strongly supports the war in Iraq. Jim is a Democrat who thinks the war was a mistake. Despite their political disagreements, they've managed to stay married for 27 years and have two children, so we figured they must know something. And Francis, we'll start with you. How do you do it? When you both disagree so strongly, do you argue about it? Do you just refuse to talk about it?
Well, of course, I take the high road.
Oh, of course.
I'm already trying to provoke my husband. It just comes up naturally because there's just so much in the news. So it'll come up, and depending on our moods, I guess, and depending on how much time we've got, we may talk about it some. I have to admit, sometimes I'm one who will try to change the subject because I'm so badly outnumbered in the house. The children also question the war and what we're doing there. I don't think that Bush is much of a president, so I'm vastly outnumbered.
Oh boy! And Jim, when it does come up, as Francis said on the news and stuff, what do you do?
Well, of course, certainly I point out that bonehead who she voted for has done something else foolish and can't seem to find anything other than to say that he's for what's right and against what's wrong, and then generally the conversation degenerates from there.
Francis really does take the high road, I guess.
See? Told you.
You just made her point, Jim.
Sometimes the children will try to referee. Sometimes they get into the fun of it, because it is fun, and they'll get into the fun of it and gang up on Mama, but Sarah will often turn to her father, who will say to me, I see your president has done something especially dumb. And she will say in a mild voice, Daddy, he's your president, too. He's our president.
Well, you know, Jim, I'm wondering, you're laughing, but, you know, we hear some talk radio, and it's vicious. Does it ever get to the point where the blood does start boiling?
Certainly. And I think the thing is that is a good point, and we are having fun with it now as we do with each other, Francis and I. The thing that's important to remember is the fun people have on talk radio, and it does get vicious, and it's an entertainment thing, and people like to be told that their ideas are right. That's why different groups seem to congregate together. That's fine on talk radio that's for entertainment. What makes me angry, frankly, is to see our government behave that way, and that's the real disagreement that I have. Certainly, George Bush is my president too.
But how do you avoid that, Francis? Do you have ground rules? I mean, how do you getting together for Thanksgiving dinner? Usually a big one, but tomorrow just the four of you, the family. So how do you do it? How do you navigate this? Help the rest of us.
The general idea is you can tell when people are getting a little upset or a little frustrated. And we generally don't go beyond that point, certainly not at the dinner table. Try to talk pretty calmly. Although, now I must say, my mother-in-law, she, at 83 years old, she pulls no punches, and she'll usually spit out something like, that fool. At which time I usually pass the chutney or something, try to redirect the conversation.
Jim, do you think you might put aside the word bonehead just in honor of the day?
Oh, no, absolutely not. You know, I think that, though, there's such a good point in what Francis says, and with the two of us, even though, you know, I never pass up an opportunity to try to work her over, but at the end of the day, and maybe this is a larger lesson, I have a lot of respect for her. I'll disagree with what Francis says, but I've been married to her for 27 years. She's a smart person. She knows what's going on. If she thinks it's a good idea, it can't be absolutely without merit, and the basis there is respect, not respect in the sense of something that's a veneer of politeness, but if you have respect for someone else, listen to what they have to say, and that's what seems to be lacking in what we call the public debate.
Well, Jim, I'm going to have to leave it at that. That's Jim Coleman. He was speaking of his wife, Frances Coleman. They'll be sitting down at the Thanksgiving dinner table together tomorrow. And one last comment. She got a zinger at you. She told us that you'll be cooking, but you need adult supervision.
She has to supervise. So cooking first, open bottles of wine second. That's the kind of supervision that she has in mind. I'm married to the only woman in Louisiana who can't cook.
Oh, that was mean.
Well, it's just a preview, Francis. Thanks for being with us, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Brine or not to brine, fresh or frozen? These are just some of the many questions facing cooks this Thanksgiving. Here Now's Rachel Gottbaum has apparently not heard Susan Stamberg's family recipe here on NPR for the past I don't know how many years, because Rachel has questions about cranberry sauce. So we sent her to the offices of Cooks Illustrated magazine in Brookline, Massachusetts, to speak to Cooks founder and host of the PBS program America's Test Kitchen, Chris Kimball.
You are now standing in front of the double doors leading in to our 2,500-foot test kitchen.
Well, why don't we start cooking and all sorts of things that we're
I
doing today.
I think we do a taste test right off the bat with a fresh bird, a high-quality fresh bird, against a frozen butterball.
Okay.
Frozen butterballs are injected with a flavored solution, a brine solution. And we took a fresh bird from a good quality producer and brined it ourselves and just roasted that off just to see the difference between a local fresh bird and a national frozen brand.
So, but is this the butterball here or is this the brined as well? Same.
I can't tell you.
Oh, because they look alike. They look alike, don't they? Oh, boy. And now I feel vulnerable because I don't know. Well, they certainly look different. I have a sense of which one is which.
One of whom you can see has a fairly dense texture and mm-hmm. is very white. Mm-hmm. And the other breast meat is actually a little bit darker and grayer. You want to take a taster?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right, let's try that. Very, very different. The fresh turkey has a lot of flavors. The other one sort of tastes like paper to me.
And it also looks like it's made out of some plastic-based substance because it doesn't look like it has much texture. And as you said, the real one, the locally grown one,
right.
is much coarser, it's chewier. It's probably a little drier, maybe,
right.
but it actually has flavor.
So basically, you're recommending to folks, go for the fresh turkey.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't mind bland, tender, wet turkey. That's what
right.
they grew up with. So it's up to you. But we prefer a chewier, more flavorful meat, yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about brining. Why did you brine? Do you always brine?
Well, a frozen butterball or a kosher bird has the equivalent of brining. It's injected, it's salted, whatever. So you know, you would not need to brine a frozen butterball. If you bought a locally fresh bird or any fresh bird, that's not brined usually. And brining means soaking in a salted water solution. So it just means that it's going to give you juicier meat, and you're much less likely to get dry, overcooked breast meat.
Okay, great. Let's check out this brining process here. Tell me what we have.
We have 2 gallons, 8 quarts of water, and we use a big plastic container. So the basic formula is 1 cup of table salt per gallon. We have 2 gallons. We have 2 cups of table salt.
And that's for the average size turkey?
Yeah, that'll definitely handle a turkey. And you're going to want to do this for about 8 hours for a 12 to 14-pound bird.
So, first of all, what temperature is our water? And you're stirring it here with a whisker.
Yeah, the key is to keep the bird under 40 degrees. And so, therefore, this would have to go in a refrigerator. Or you could use, I have a beer chest right over here, which you could use that as well.
Okay, but basically you just poured the salt right in the water here, okay?
This is, we've rinsed this bird out, taken the giblets out, and we're going to put that down. There she goes, in the water, to cover. And that'll sit, again, a 12 to 14-pound bird will sit about 8 hours. You can do it overnight. And be sure you rinse it off thoroughly when it comes out.
Let's talk about your philosophy of stuffing, because I know you have one.
The problem with stuffing, there's a big ball of it here, is when you stuff a bird with cold or room temperature stuffing, it takes longer for the stuffing to come up to 160 than it does for the white meat, the breast meat, to hit 165. So you end up overcooking the breast meat because you want the stuffing to be safe. There is a way around this, which is you can take the stuffing, throw it in a microwave, and then stuff the turkey so that you get a head start to the stuffing.
So what do we have in front of us here?
When we developed the recipe 6 or 7 years ago for cranberry sauce, we found that there's a recipe on the back of the raw cranberry bag. And it was perfect, except we added 1/4 teaspoon of salt. It's very simple to make, and it's a lot better than what you buy in the supermarket. So this is going to be a little test of that.
So basically, what you're saying is people do not need to be intimidated by cranberry sauce. You can make the cranberry sauce. And we are looking here at the difference between what you've made and what?
and a store-bought version. You're just taking sugar, water, salt, cranberries, essentially, and cooking them on top of the stove for 10 or 15 minutes and then taking it off the stove and letting it sit. I mean, that's about it. And the recipe's on the back of those bags of whole raw cranberries.
If you want to get a little creative with it, what do you recommend?
You could certainly add a little bit of orange zest to it if you wanted. You could certainly, at the end, add some nuts, you know, toasted nuts to it if you wanted. I mean, for me, on Turkey Day, being creative is not a good thing. That's a really bad thing.
All right, well, let's try that.
You will tell a difference here. It tastes that one now. This is the one that's...
Yeah, this is gloppy.
You can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if there's any cranberries in there.
No. It's a red jelly substance. That's one of the great secrets of Thanksgiving is the cranberry sauce is anybody, my 7-year-old could make it.
You've changed my life on the cranberry sauce.
You
have changed my life. Now I am not freaked out and I can do it. So where are we next? Are we going to talk potatoes?
Mm-hmm. First of all, for making mashed potatoes, we use Yukon Golds. They have a lot of flavor. You can use russets. The thing we do differently, two things, is we boil them in their skin. And that keeps the water out, so it keeps a nice, light, fluffy mashed potato. And then we peel them when they're still warm. You can stick a fork into them and use a paring knife to peel them. The peel comes off easily. And then we mash them, 2 pounds of potatoes, with a stick, 1 stick, 8 tablespoons of melted butter.
Ooh, and that, daddy-o.
Well, we're not finished with the cream and half-naff yet. We're getting started. And that coats the starch in the potatoes, so you don't get that gluey texture. It gets nice, light texture. Then we'll add the warm half-and-half to it after that.
So now we're going to see if the turkey is done and how that is done. Now, how long has this baby been cooking?
Do 45 minutes at 400 degrees, breast side down. Mm-hmm. Then we flip it and reduce the temperature to 325. And for a 12 to 14-pound bird, that's another 50 to 60 minutes. So it would be an hour and a half to hour and 45 minutes, roughly speaking. The two places you want to look at, first, obviously, is in the breast. And you want to make sure you get in the center of the breast. This is a thermopen, digital thermometer. So you're trying to get it in the middle. And I'll put it in horizontally in the breast, meat like that. And it says 151, 152. That's not good enough. But try the other side. Now, this is interesting. This one's got a different reading. We're looking at 172, 171, 170, 169. So you'll find sometimes that one side will be cooking quicker than the other side.
So what do you do?
Well, I would now, if I were doing this, I'm going to do this. I'm going to turn this around in the oven and flip it around. The next thing you want to do is the inside of the thigh. The thigh, you really want to be looking for 170 to 175 and the breast meat 165.
Okay.
So you need about 10 more degrees. So we're going to turn this around the oven, put it back in, and let it finish up.
Well, thank you very much for enlightening me and our listeners. And these have been very good tips. I now know I can go home and make some cranberries and not have an anxiety attack. So I appreciate that.
So go roast the big one and do a good job, right?
All right. Thank you.
That was Here Now's Rachel Gottbaum speaking with Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Illustrated Magazine. For these and other Thanksgiving recipes, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us Thanksgiving Day, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.